We're talking about the removal and destruction of statues as protests continue over racial injustice. More than 70 Confederate monuments have been taken down since the 2015 shooting at a Charleston church. That's according to data by the Washington Post. They found about a third of those monuments were toppled in the weeks following the death of George Floyd. So how do you feel about the removal of statues of Confederate soldiers? What about statues of U.S. presidents? What did you think about protesters in Madison taking down the Forward statue and Hans Christian Haug? We're at 800-642-1234. Christy Clark Pujara is an associate professor of history in the Afro-American Studies Department at UW-Madison. Christy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Steve Kantrowitz is the Plainert Bascom Professor of History at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome to you.
Glad to be here.
Well, Steve, George Floyd's death on Memorial Day has reignited this movement to remove all sorts of statues and monuments that are symbols of racial injustice. Some have been toppled, others have been taken down by local authorities. How did we get so many monuments on the Civil War?
Well, monuments are expressions of political power, and military victory is one form of political power. So there are a lot of monuments all over the country representing the victory of the United States over the Confederate Rebellion. But, and many of those were erected shortly after the Civil War and on into the late 19th century. But by the late 19th century, the forces that had lost the Civil War won the peace and reestablished one-party, whites-only rule across most of the South. And as part of their triumph, erected hundreds and hundreds of monuments to the Confederacy, to its leaders, to its soldiers, to its generals, and just to the idea of white supremacy, as in the Liberty Place Monument in New Orleans. And those statues became part of the sort of statuary monumental legacy of the Civil War as well. And we've been living with those, the monuments to the defeated rebel traitors of the Civil War for almost as long as we've been living with the monuments to the victorious United States.
And most Confederate statues and memorials were put up in southern states, as you're mentioning, but that's not exclusively. There are monuments that I've noticed in the Midwest, in the West, Arizona as well. So this is not just exclusively a southern or deep south thing.
No, that's right. In fact, there was a Confederate monument or two, depending on how you count it, in Madison up until a couple years ago. There's two ways that happens. One is that there are Confederate descendants and Confederate claims to territories outside of what was, you know, the rebel states during the 4 years of the Civil War. And that includes actually places in New Mexico and Arizona and other parts that were never part of the Confederacy. But there are also monuments to Confederate graves, and that's what Madison had, and that's what a few other places that hosted Confederate prison camps for Confederate troops during the Civil War.
Christy, what do we learn from these statues?
We learn how successful the Confederacy was in winning the peace, right? Because the fact that we even have a discussion in this country about whether or not we should have the statues of traitors to the United States of America all over the country tells you how successful they were in convincing the majority of white Americans that they had a place and a right, right? We don't have statues to any other enemy, right? We don't have Mussolini statues. We don't do that, right? But when the Civil War is understood by many people still today to be this kind of tragic quarrel between brothers, that it was about states' rights, that it wasn't about slavery, we are still having this conversation. And so it tells us where we are right now in racial relations in the United States that we're even having the discussion.
So you're saying that these statues are not so much about history, they're much more about our contemporary thinking and the choices we're making?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, the same thing can be, you know, extended toward debates about the Confederate flag. The Confederacy was very clear. If you read the Articles of the Confederacy, why they seceded, the secession that was led by South Carolina, they are very clear. They're not opaque. They're not vague. They seceded from the Union and attacked the United States of America over their right to hold Black bodies as property. And the fact that we are still in the discussion about whether or not we should honor a nation that came into being, the Confederacy, to hold Black bodies as property, reveals a lot about racism in America, our understanding of the Civil War, our understanding of slavery.
Well, let's take a call now. Matt is joining us from Holcomb, Minnesota. Hi, Matt.
Hello, how are you?
Doing okay. What is on your mind about these statues?
Well, I just want to let you know that I'm actually a retired police officer, and I just feel it's sad that these people are taking it upon themselves to remove these statues when it's our history, especially if Abraham Lincoln. I mean, he was responsible for the Emancipation Proclamation, and yet they want to destroy his statue. If people want to protest, that's their right, and I support them for that. But riots and tearing down statues, like Ulysses S. Grant, he was the general who led the Union Army to end slavery. I mean, it just seems like they just want to damage property for just for the fact of damaging the property.
Matt, thank you for bringing this to the table. Steve, what about these monuments that were of people who were against slavery, abolitionists?
Mm-hmm. So your caller refers to the Ulysses S. Grant statue that was toppled in Golden Gate Park a couple of days ago. I've been following the coverage on that and talking with colleagues out there. And the sense out there is that particular toppling of the Grant statue doesn't appear to have been particularly politically motivated. It seems like some young white kids acting out. But that doesn't answer the broader question, which is how we think about these statues of figures that we can't describe, as Christy properly did, can't describe as traitors, as slaveholders, as other things that we should have a broad consensus on as completely unacceptable in the public sphere. What about statues that don't present those kinds of challenges, or that indeed appear to many people to have that kind of power? I've been involved in a conversation the last couple of days with an old friend from college who is very upset about the Christopher Columbus statue coming down in New Haven, Connecticut. I'm not. I think there are plenty of good reasons to reevaluate the legacy. And the broader point here is, when we approach these statues, we're having arguments with one another about political power and meaning. We can come back maybe after the break and think more about the specifics of Grant or even of Lincoln. But none of these figures is there's not a perfect consensus around any of these figures.
Steve Kantrowitz studies race, politics, citizenship in the 19th century. Christy Clark Pujara is the Afro-American Studies Department, studying experiences of color in French and British North America. And you, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. Protesters in North Carolina dismantling parts of a Confederate monument near the state capitol in Raleigh. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have a pair of historians with us as we look at the removal of statues around the country in this moment of reckoning of our nation's history and oppression of minority groups. Should all statues come down? Are we capable of evaluating collectively and deciding which historical figures should be honored? What do you think of statues coming down at the state capitol in Madison? Join in, 800-642-1234. We have UW-Madison historians Steve Kantorowicz with us and Christy Clark Pujara. They stay with us. Christy, some of these statues were built in the years after the Civil War, but most were produced decades later in the early 20th century when states were writing Jim Crow laws and cementing racial segregation. And I think this circles back to your idea about contemporary issues. How do we go about reckoning these statues that honestly are only decades old, that they don't date back to right at the Civil War?
I think that we really have to understand what statues and monuments are. They're not unbiased, objective history. They tell us who we think is important in a particular moment, who we want to amplify, who we want to put on a pedestal. Just like the last caller mentioned that, you know, Abraham Lincoln was responsible for ending slavery. Abraham Lincoln was responsible for signing the Emancipation Proclamation, but hundreds of thousands of enslaved people of African descent who ran away to Union lines and changed the Union war effort were responsible for ending slavery, right? They are the momentum that was the shift change in the war. And that's a problem that is not something that is well known. It's a problem that we, when we think about the freedom of African Americans, we think about a singular figure. So that's part of the problem with having these kinds of statues, is that it doesn't tell the broad and complex history of these places. Now, I am in no way, shape, or form equating a statue of Abraham Lincoln with a Confederate statue. They're not in the same conversation for me. Confederate statues, there's just no, in my opinion, a reason why they exist, other than to continue to perpetuate white supremacy. We can have a conversation about other types of statues, and in particular, the ones you're talking about that exist in the 20th century that are Confederate, those are clear expressions of white supremacy. They are a reaction to Black people pushing back against Jim Crow laws in many places.
Let's go to Kevin now, joining us from Middleton. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how are you today? Thanks. This is a good good conversation right now. And I agree wholeheartedly with the guest right there. I loved how she described them as traitors to the United States. And I was describing to the guy taking my interview, the statues in so many cases are just an absolute slap in the face to African Americans and to the laws that were initially put in place. There are obvious shows of defiance about what their opinion really is on the matter of owning African American people. But the point that I really wanted to make, Kate, was when a state-sponsored government bombs somewhere or destroys a neighborhood or an area, whether it be us against any other country, what are they trying to achieve? They're trying to stop a certain action or a certain policy that we don't agree with. Well, like right now, the violence that's taken place, they are in direct reaction, I feel, to, like, we're done with the policies and the actions that have been taking place for all of these years. And oftentimes a government will justify the bombing of a place because our national security is being compromised. Well, an entire race of people's, like, security is completely being compromised. So when people are like, I hope the officer that called that was really upset about the monuments, I hope he's just as upset about the neighborhood that, pick any country, say ours, might have wiped out in, say, Syria, the wars going on in Yemen. I mean, there's neighborhoods being wiped out every day in the name of interests and national security.
Yeah, Kevin, thank you for the call. Steve, how do you then judge what is worth memorializing?
Well, we don't judge, right? Like, historians don't judge. Individuals may have opinions, but I mean, in a perfect kind of, like, abstract democracy, of course, we'd have a reasoned debate over every question like this. And we would sit down and reason together and have a process for determining, you know, who gets memorialized and who doesn't, and whether a statue is still appropriate and when it should come down. And this would be part of our civic conversation. But the fact is, we don't have those conversations. we put these monuments up. The state puts these monuments up. Civic bodies put these monuments up. And then they sit in the landscape. And the statues are not history. They're expressions of particular forces in history. But they're not where we learn actual history. They're where we learn certain moral lessons that the people who put them up want to teach us. And some of them are what we would consider to be wholesome and important lessons. And some of them, like the Confederate monuments, are terrible lessons that we've nonetheless tolerated up until the present moment.
We're talking with UW-Madison history professors Steve Kantrowitz and Christy Clark Pujara about the removal of statues and other symbols of oppression against minority communities. And taking your calls, let's bring in Sandy now, joining us from Mineral Point. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. So I totally understand taking down Confederate statues. What I don't understand is why Forward came down. She's a symbol of Wisconsin. And why an abolitionist came down, because abolitionists obviously are against slavery.
And Christy, would you like to tackle this first with the Forward statue?
Yes. Forward is a statue of white expansion into the Midwest. And the fact that indigenous people are not part of this conversation is really problematic. Forward literally represents white domination and colonial colonialism, right? And the fact that many people don't even think of that vantage point, don't think of the land that we are on, that I'm on right now, which is Ho-Chunk land, and what that Forward statue means for indigenous folks who occupy this place. It was supposed to symbolize enlightenment and civilization, as if indigenous people weren't already civilized and enlightened. So I think we need to think about the fuller context of these statues. And I also think it's very important to understand that just because someone was an abolitionist doesn't mean they weren't racist. There are a number of white abolitionists who also were proponents of the American Colonization Society, which said, yes, black people should be free, but they should be gone. And we actually have the historical documentation of racism on the part of Haig, right? That, yes, was he an abolitionist in terms of he didn't think slavery was a system that should be continued to be perpetuated? Did he have very racist views? And that's not my opinion. You can just go to the Wisconsin Historical Society and look at his letters in which he refers to Black people as N-words and monkeys. But I do think that those statues deserve a conversation about whether or not they need to be in place now.
Let's bring in Logan in Green Bay. Hi, Logan.
Hi. Thank you. What I wanted to say, I'm not going to discuss the entire list of people that were really cruel. I want to mention Andrew Jackson, whom I found despicable. And his statue should be taken down very gently and put in the museum and call it the Museum of Infamy. And that will preserve history. And others also, like his ilk, their statue should be taken down and put in the museum.
Logan, thank you. Steve, Andrew Jackson.
You know, I'm so glad that Christy raised the point she did about the different meanings of almost every American statue to indigenous people in North America, because Andrew Jackson is sort of the central case in point, right? The architect of Indian removal, which is to say the deportation and ethnic cleansing of the American South and then of the American Midwest, of most of its indigenous people. And how that's not been part of our national conversation outside of Indian country and a few other places is pretty shocking. But this points to a really important and broad question about these statues, which is that we have not wrestled with the difficult histories of the United States, in particular the histories of slavery and its sequels, and the history of conquest and the continuing conquest of North America as a settler nation. And what that means is that we have these suppressed conversations in which people who know a different history and have experienced a different history are constantly trying to tell the rest of us, listen, this is not the history I have experienced. This is not the full, true history of the United States. And when you suppress that conversation for long enough, you're going to get a backlash to that.
Steve and Christy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks very much.
Christy Clark Pujara and Steve Kantrowitz, they're history professors at UW-Madison. Coming up, we look at how Harley-Davidson is weathering the pandemic and whether it plans to attract more motorcycle riders, whether it's working. We'll talk with a corporate finance analyst right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're checking in on how Milwaukee-based Harley-Davidson is doing in these difficult times. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In recent years, Harley made a push to market to women and minority riders to expand its base beyond its core demographic of older white men. And this week, it cut ties with a Tennessee dealership after racist comments were allegedly posted on the owner's Facebook page. Are you a Harley rider or an investor or a dealer? What do you think of the company's plans to boost sales? We're at 800-642-1234. Val Sibelkov is the Hans G. Storr Associate Professor in Finance at UW-Milwaukee. His research focuses on capital structure, corporate cash policies, and corporate governance. Val, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
So Harley was not like... unlike other manufacturers, Harley announced on March 19th it would temporarily shut down most of its U.S. production. And then the Wall Street Journal said it restarted its lines in mid-May. How does a work stoppage affect manufacturing and Harley's bottom line?
Well, obviously, it is a concern to many companies, and especially to manufacturers such as Harley. It probably wasn't hit as bad as other companies that operate, such as restaurants, but it's still significant.
Why was Harley-Davidson knocked off the S&P 500 this month? The S&P 500 measures stock performance of 500 large companies listed on stock exchanges in our country. So what was going on there?
Well, so basically the S&P 500 tracks largest companies, like you said. And over the past probably 5 years, the stock price of Harley-Davidson has been falling. And so one of the criterion for the inclusion or for the stock to be on the S&P 500 has to remain one of those big companies. And because the stock price of Harley fell, it no longer satisfied probably the requirement for being a large company. And so they got delisted from or removed from S&P 500 as a result. So it's primarily a result of the fall in the value of the equity of the company, so in the market capitalization of Harley. So over the last 5 years, I think about 5 years ago, it was at sort of its peak. It was at about $11 billion, give or take. Now it's about 3.7 or close to $4 billion, most recent price. And usually companies that are, I think the inclusion into S&P 500, I think the company has to be above $8 billion. So as Harley fell, obviously it had to be removed.
Which investors might care whether a company is listed on the S&P 500?
All investors might care because there's obviously several benefits to being on the S&P 500. One of the benefits is that there are some companies that could have, or some investors that can invest, especially large institutional investors that can invest only in S&P 500 companies, only in large companies. Being in the S&P 500 usually subjects you, or academic research shows that it subjects you to greater scrutiny. So basically, if you're on the S&P 500, the company is more visible, gets followed more, and so supposedly the performance of the companies tends to be better.
Oh, so you may even have more cachet and more exposure, as you're saying. So it could perhaps hurt the brand not being on the S&P?
I'm not sure whether it hurts the brand, but I mean, okay. Because the company, the market capitalization fell, obviously it shows that the performance has been poor in terms of the stock price. But usually, being on the S&P 500 gets you additional scrutiny and better performance, everything else equal. So managers are more under the light,
well,
so to speak.
Let's scrutinize the sales slump in recent years. Why are fewer people buying Harleys?
Also, if we're talking about sales per se, if you look at the data, if you look at the stock, accounting statements, the sales decline hasn't been as dramatic as the decline in stock price. So between the year end 2014 and year end 2019, their sales declined by about 15%. So that's obviously big, but not as huge as the decline in the stock price. But their stock price has been hit more. Why their sales were declining? Well, there's a couple of reasons, obviously. Like you mentioned, their core, I mean, if we think about what Harley Davidson is and what their product is, it's motorcycles. And at this day and age, their motorcycles are more of a luxury, more of a, I would say, you know, entertainment, or more of a toy. And people who buy their products, they buy them because not out of necessity, but more probably for fun. I mean, some do buy out of necessity, but a lot of their products are quite, on the higher end of the market.
A luxury, we're talking about Harley Davidson's financial challenges with Val Sibelkoff from UW Milwaukee's finance department. You can join in. What questions do you have about Harley Davidson and how the company is operating? Are you a Harley rider or an investor? What do you think of the company's plans for boosting sales? What types of motorcycles do you think Harley should be making right now? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Val, how has the company tried to boost sales in recent years? Is it in products? Is it in markets? What is it trying to do?
It's actually both. So they try to, as far as I understand, expand their product offering. So one of the things that they did, they introduced an electric bike. Another thing that they did was to get more into the cheaper products, or at least the products with a lower price point. On the expanding geographically, they try to get into newer markets, such as markets in the Southeastern Asia, like India, I think, and possibly China. They're trying to do that. But I think that it's more important to get into. Obviously, they would benefit greater, of course, if they were to get from this, luxury or toy market more into the necessity market. Something that would appeal to a wider customer base or wider demographics, obviously.
When you say that it released its first electric motorcycle in September, has that bike been received well enough to kind of calm investors' concerns?
I'm not sure. I don't know if it's been received well enough. And obviously, the stock price didn't go
do anything. Uh-huh.
go significantly up. But I'm not sure it's been solved their problem, so to speak.
Well, let's take a call on this. Let's go to Tom joining us from Madison. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I'm a former Harley motorcycle owner and a former Harley Davidson stockholder. I took a real beating on my stock, but I turned it around and bought a brand new Volvo. Company was not responsive. Yeah, it's a beautiful car. My bike was worthless on the secondary market. The company did not respond. You know, I am on the record and on video at their corporate meetings imploring them to get rid of a lot of the trifling things that tarnished the brand image and all of the offshore manufacturing, and to bring it back here to the U.S. and focus on U.S. and Canadian jobs. They weren't listening to this. I got sick of it. I watched the stock drop. I finally decided time to sell, and I bought a brand new Volvo V60 cross country wagon.
Tom, thank you for telling your story. Val, how has Harley handled its shareholders and the decisions it's made?
Well, obviously, a lot of shareholders are upset, I think both individual shareholders and some institutional shareholders, from what I read, were upset about, if the stock price drops, 70% or more, it's not too good.
The company's president and CEO stepped down in February toward the beginning of this year after years of declining sales. What have you seen out of a switch in CEOs at the top?
So a new person came in, and I'm not sure whether it's there's two sides to that, right? So one thing is, if poor performance has been associated with the old executive, then removing is one side of the story. But also bringing somebody who can change things around is also very important.
We're looking at Harley Davidson and its economic situation as it stands. Val Sibelkoff is the UW-Milwaukee Finance Department teaching corporate finance. Do you support Harley tapping Jochen Zeitz to lead the company after the previous CEO stepped down? Do you agree with the vision Zeitz has laid out? What type of motorcycles do you think Harley should be producing now? What do you think of their electric bikes? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about Harley Davidson and the challenges facing an iconic Wisconsin company. What types of motorcycles do you think Harley should be producing? Should the company focus on big, loud bikes, or do you want smaller, sleeker models? How much does it matter to you that Harleys are made here in the U.S.? Join in 800-642-1234. Val Sibelkoff teaches corporate finance at UW-Milwaukee, and Val stays with us. Let's take another call now. Richard is here from Madison. Hi, Richard.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, my thing with Harley Davidson, and I'm diehard, I love Harleys, but I cannot buy a new one. You go to the dealership, I'm financially secure, and I went to the dealership twice since everything has started, COVID-19-wise has started, and said, look, I'll put $5,000-$10,000 down on a new bike that costs $26,000, and you go to Harley for financing, and they won't work with you. They won't allow it. I have a military pension, guaranteed payment every month, and they say, no, we're good. And so if you're trying to target a new, younger audience, how do you expect them to come in and deal with you if you won't work with them? you know, you got to meet a guy halfway.
Richard, thank you for the call. Val, what challenges do you see there in how Harley runs its financing options for customers?
Well, so I agree with the caller they need to tap obviously into wider customer base, and getting to these younger customers is very important for that, both in terms of again financing and possibly in terms of image and in terms of wider product offerings. What their financing details are, I'm not particularly sure, but obviously they provide a lot of financing to their customers, and they make a lot of money on financing as well. So if you look at their financial statements, pretty much I would say about, you know, half of their earnings comes from the financing that they provide. And the other half, roughly, comes from the actual production.
And so, as Richard is saying, you know, if someone is saying, "I'm going to come in and I'm going to put $10,000 down on this $26,000 new bike," but you have sky high interest rates to finance this bike, that you could lose customers over that.
Certainly, yes. That is a concern. But again, if you want to. So given their, you know, dropping stock price, you have to expand customer base much more to regain that market value. There's certainly, in my opinion, there's a lot of opportunities there, but the main opportunities lie in trying to expand from this niche market that they're in to a wider market. I mean, truth be told, Harley faced incredible competition because, again, when you think about what their product is, it's basically, you know, a leisure product and an entertainment product. And there's a lot of competition in that space. So obviously we have various video games, we have Netflix, YouTube, even regular electric bicycles that came to the market. And I would imagine that puts a lot of pressure on Harley, you know, in terms of competition.
Do we know how any type of market penetration Harley is getting in recent years on those younger riders, as Richard mentioned, and also women riders?
They had several initiatives under the old or the CEO that stepped down recently. How successful those have been, it's hard to judge what sales would have been without them. So it's hard to get that data, obviously. But given that their sales declined, it hasn't been as successful as probably.
You can make some inferences.
To sustain those sales.
Yeah, you can make some inferences to that. So let's look at the CEO change here. So CEO Matt Levitich steps down, and then this is earlier in the year, and now you have the new president and CEO, who is Jochen Zeitz. What vision has he laid out for improving the company's profits?
So the new CEO, Mr. Zeitz, he has a very good and strong track record. So he's done amazing things at the company that he turned around
wasn't
his career.
Puma?
Yes. Okay. So it was a German manufacturer of sports apparel. Certainly, I think Harley is a bit of a different animal in this respect. And so in Puma, his record was that he improved the stock value of the company about 40 times. So he increased it by about 4,000%.
Wow.
So that's obviously a very huge accomplishment.
Yeah.
Can it be expected of Harley? It's hard to tell. Again, in my opinion, there are opportunities out there, but obviously there are challenges as well. So Mr. Zeitz is the one who, based on his experience, at least what he did at Puma was that he looked at more of a broader, you know, out of the box thinking. And that's certainly a big plus, basically. But whether that would be, whether it is possible to do that at Harley again, it's unclear. We hope that it is, but time will tell.
We're talking about Harley-Davidson with Val Sibelkoff from UW-Milwaukee, getting your insights on the company, 800-642-1234. Val, the Milwaukee Business Journal is saying that local dealers are now seeing strong sales in used bikes and in maintenance. Why might that be the case?
Well, probably because of the shutdown we've seen, unfortunately, increase in distress of people, economic distress particularly. And so possibly there's not a lot of cash that people can commit to new bicycles. So that could be.
So they're keeping their old ones going or buying used. You know, let's look at President Trump's trade policies for a moment. As we saw the tariffs on steel, how did that impact Harley?
Probably, I'm not sure where Harley takes its steel from. So it is possible that it is U.S. steel, and so they weren't that affected. But certainly what Harley is trying to do with trying to bring a lot of that manufacturing to foreign countries is that they try to reduce the costs of their production. And so they say that bikes that they sell in the U.S. are U.S. produced, and then they produce in foreign markets for foreign consumers. And so that's certainly, they are trying to reduce the impact of tariffs by doing so.
What might be their advantages of manufacturing domestically? Because I would assume it would cost more.
Reputation and quality probably are the two big ones.
Reputation and quality. Your customers like the fact that it is made in the U.S.?
Well, yes, obviously. And then also, it is possible that there are some quality benefits to produce locally as opposed to where production has been set up, where there's people who's been working on that for quite a long time versus somebody where you have to get together a new workforce, somebody who hasn't been doing that for a while. Possibly there are some quality concerns there as well.
Val, thank you for joining us.
Was a pleasure.
Val Sibelkoff is an associate professor in finance at UW-Milwaukee. We've been talking about Harley's declining sales, new challenges amid the pandemic. Just ahead, a clinical psychologist shares how parents can talk about the pandemic with kids who have developmental challenges. We'll also hear about a new children's book that gives families a window into living with autism. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.